Ladies and gentlemen, as well as kids of all ages, welcome to RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we have an interview with author Rob Connolly. We look at some extreme props for Cthulhu. And finally, we discuss RPGs that are not RPGs. Well, we want to welcome everyone to episode one of season two of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and with us always is Mark and Zach. And together, we're going to be your hosts here for RPG Circus. This is the first podcast of the 2010 year. And I'm not sure if I want to say 2010 or 2010 yet. There's been a debate among everyone I know.
Yeah, I'm just sad I can't say
2010 flows a little bit easier.
Yeah, I'm sad I can't say aught anymore. I like saying aught 9 and aught 8. It sounded cool. Can't do that now.
Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of the way things are.
Did everyone have a good New Year, Christmas, holiday, whatever?
I had a great Christmas.
Any gaming-related stuff there, Mark or Jeff? Or
yeah, I got a mouse guard.
Oh, cool.
Excellent. Yeah, so. Now you can explain the rules to me.
Exactly. You guys had been pointing out that you thought that the way that the text was a little bit weird. You thought it was interesting the way they explained everything. For me, I picked right up on it because that's actually how the rules for Burning Wheel are all written as well.
See, sort you're already a leg up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, no, it was a little confusing for me, but that's okay. But actually, on my side of the house, my wife got me a $25 gift certificate for the local gaming store, so I spent it on miniatures.
Oh, right on.
Hey, well, you know, honestly, there wasn't a book that I wanted, and it's like, you know what, I can always use more miniatures, and that gives me more time to paint them.
Yeah.
Got to expand my painting skills, get them above that level that I'm currently at. So. But other than that, not really much. All right, so I think we should probably get into the news. Hurry, hurry, hurry! Step right up, folks, and let us dazzle you with some RPG news! Well, there's a little bit of news this go-around. Not too much. The kind of big one was, I guess, Goodman Games is thinking about changing how they're doing modules. That was kind of a interesting little post for them. I think some people had some disagreement with his analysis of the last few years in terms of publishing modules. For various editions, but I guess the gist of it is he's thinking about maybe doing something a little more generic with having PDF, you know, downloadable, conversions or something. Is kind of
for
the gist I got.
Systems. Yeah, actually, on this one, Jeff, I'd like to bring in our guest Rob Connolly because Rob's actually written for Goodman Games.
Oh well,
and I
maybe.
I was kind of curious to get his opinion on it, Rob, if you wouldn't mind. Did you see this week, or did it fly by?
Yeah, I even commented on it. You know, I've been to 6 cons in the past year in Northwest PA, and you know, there's a lot of among the 4E fans. There's a lot of, you know, if it's not made by Wizards, it's why bother using it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think about it at the time, but in later comments in his post, a lot of people commented, yeah, they're, you know, because of the DDI program and the inability to enter third-party stuff in it, and of course, it won't be accepted at any RPGA event. Mm-hmm. You know, any third-party manufacturer has a tough road to go.
Right. Mark, have you found that's kind of the case as far as that... I guess cult of legitimacy or whatever you want to say, officialdom, you know,
yeah,
that sprung up in the game as well? Or?
Well, I've always used lots of third-party books. I would say more than half of my books are third-party published stuff. But at the same time, I don't use DDI. I haven't gotten a chance to sit down and use that.
You haven't been converted to it yet?
Yeah, exactly.
I got to tell you, it's a when I play a couple I make it a point to play one or two RPG events because who knows whether I'm going to get a writing gig for 4E or not. So I wanted to know the system. And, you know, the first one, I hand wrote my character. And then for the second one, I tried DDI. And it was, the difference was, it's a great program.
Mm-hmm. Well, with me, I've actually found quite a few different third-party, like, Excel files online, where you are able to, it punches in all your information for you. But with that, I mean, they're not going to put in third party stuff, but you'll still be able to find official, well, not official, but Wizards only Excel sheets every once in a while. So the fact that you're not able to use the third party stuff for that is a detriment, but I think it's also a problem that you just aren't seeing as much third party stuff around as you used to.
Right.
For the new edition. So I think once I've seen a Goodman Games book in a Borders somewhere.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's going to be happening. I don't think a lot of the chain brick and mortar stores, I don't think they're quite that interested anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all lost to them, really.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of loss, as many of our listeners will know, I mean, we interviewed the wannabe author of What to Feed Your Raiding Party, Jennifer. She was on, and fun person to talk to. Very interesting product. Unfortunately, her project goal for in the Kickstarter system didn't quite make the I think it was 1750 or something like that that she was supposed to get. It kind of fell to, well, like about $1,000, so she was about $700 short.
Yeah.
But the good news is that she is going to continue working on the project. She has a new website dedicated to that. So at some point in the future, we may actually still see that product.
Oh, good for her.
That's good. My wife is actually really looking forward to that book.
Yeah, I don't know. Got a little feedback there. I was really kind of sad that she didn't get all of her money. And it didn't look good anyway. About halfway through the month, she was nowhere near even halfway. So that was kind of sad. But luckily, she's decided the heck with it. We're going to continue on. She's going to try to do some smaller fundraisings, I believe, at that point. And I think I'll include a link in the show notes to her website. And so you, everyone out there, if you are interested in her product, please go there and see what she has to say and what she's doing. And hopefully when she has her little mini fundraisers, you'll go ahead and support that product. Of course, in the old school news, we have a couple of items. First off, is Brave Halfling Publishing, or Brave Halfling, is going to publish the Swords and Wizardry White Box. And that's kind of which is interesting because I guess effectively that kind of makes it as quasi-fork a little bit, from what I understand.
Yeah. They've actually already, the pre-orders, I believe, have sold out.
Really?
Wow. So, yeah, it sounds like people who want the White Box are going to have to wait. If they didn't order one and they don't find one from wherever, they're going to have to wait until later in the year when John Adams of BHP there will be making a few more.
Yeah,
so I don't know what the pre-order was. I imagine it wasn't a huge number, but that's great that they sold out. You know, year of the box set, hopefully.
Year of the box set. That's right. That was your wish for this year, wasn't it?
That was my wish for the year. And if you think about it, Jim over at Lamentations of the Flame Princess has been brewing up some stuff, and we have the Dragon Age box set by Green Ronin.
Ronin.
Oh man, every time.
I know.
And then there's also the Swords and Wizardry White Box, and I think I'm forgetting one other.
Oh, I'm sure we are, and the listeners out there, please let us know which one we're missing. We're missing one. Please let us know.
So. I don't know. That's exciting news. I love box sets. I think they're just it's just great to have this, everything in one. And I don't know. There's a legacy about them too, I guess.
Yeah, I know. I still have my old Gamma World box set. I forget which edition that was. Among a few other box sets that I own. So, and other old school news, of course, the Tarja people. Now, actually, finally, I think, have their own website, which was kind of interesting. It's like, I guess, and it's weird because there's not a lot there, but their wiki's off of it, and then they have a link to their blog that they've been doing, and then they have a link to their mailing list. Hopefully there's going to be more content added, but it's nice that they finally went ahead and got their actual full website, which is basically just called traditionalgaming.org.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very exciting for them.
Yeah. I think there will be more. There's a lot of good stuff happening that's not, I want to say the focus is kind of, people have been talking about the focus being more on, as they put it, butts in seats, you know, for conventions and whatnot. So I think there's going to be a really good at quite a few larger and medium-sized conventions, as well as hopefully Gen Con. We're going to see some more traditional gaming events. So I certainly hope that's the case.
Yeah, I know I'll be
running some. So
yeah, that would actually be nice. Finally, many of our listeners, that's you guys out there. You probably know that we've always had we've talked to our buddy Chatty, and it appears that Chatty and our friend Dave the Game from Critical Hits looks like they might be merging their blogs a little bit. I guess they've been discussing it lately, and that's I considered fairly positive because, you know, actually all three of us hosts, we all blog as well. It can get
Rob
very
has one as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There you go. Our guest does as well. Sorry. I'm being a horrible host here today. I'm not including everybody. But the interesting thing is that, you know, this is unfortunately what needs to happen. All of us don't have time to write every day, even though we'd love to. And you know, a lot of us have put a lot of energy into our blogs, some of us less so. And you know, we want to see our blogs continue, but we don't have time to post something every day. And readers being readers, I mean, if you've been going to a blog all the time, and if you're not using an aggregator or something, and you know, you go, hey, they haven't posted in a while, what's going on? Then, you know, you kind of say, I'm not going to visit them for a while. And so it's nice to have several people. I mean, let's face it, Gnome Stew is, I mean, they released their hit counts just a while ago, and I mean, it's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But they can do that.
Just shy of about 1,000 hits a day, I think. So that's
So,
really good for
them. Which is very impressive. How can they do that? That's because they have multiple authors. You know, they, not one guy is trying to do every single single one. And so, yeah, I think for Chatty and the guys over at Critical Hits, I think this will be a good thing. And I, you know, they're going to, and no one, you know, Chatty asked if anyone would, what they thought, any negative things, and no one's really negative. So I look forward to that. Yes. I think that would be a good fit for him. Because besides, Chatty's going to be very busy. I mean, he's been doing a lot more submissions lately, so hopefully he'll get some more stuff out there, and I'm excited about that too.
Yeah, that'd be excellent.
So, you know, in the community, we love to see what people we consider our friends do very exciting things. Does anyone else have any news that I need to announce or we need to announce to everybody?
Oh, Pendragon.
Ooh.
Oh, my gosh. How could we forget? Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, Greg Stafford announced just yesterday, actually, yesterday at the time we're recording this, that King Arthur Pendragon is going to have a new is going to have a new publisher. So there are basically no details except for that yet, except it's out of the White Wolf limbo that it was in. Basically, as I understand it, someone left that company and they took Pendragon with them. So that's one of those RPGs that I always wanted to get a little more involved with and never got the chance. So I'm really hoping that perhaps this is the, maybe this is the time, you know. So that's one of the best regarded RPGs, I think, across the board by a number of people. So we'll make sure to get that link in the show notes as well.
Very, very exciting, yeah. So I think that's it. All right, folks, that's it for the sideshow. It's time for everyone to go inside the big top, for it's time for the main attraction. All right. Well, in Ring 1, of course, we have Rob. And I believe, Zach, you're going to introduce Rob to us?
Yes. I've known Rob online now for, I guess, a number of years. And Rob Conley is our guest. He's the author of several gaming books, to include Points of Light, which was one of the first, around the time of 4E was released. Rob, wasn't it really kind of one of the first 4E-ish settings, although it was usable with any system? Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, it was actually proposed at an old school.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And of course, Points of Light being the setting, implied setting for 4th edition, that was kind of cool as well.
Goodman Games saw that, or Joseph Goodman saw that, you know, what the guy described was pretty close to what I was, the four lands I was describing, and says, it's just Points of Light, is it trademark? And we looked it up, and it wasn't trademark, so he decided to use it for the series title.
Very cool. Good. And now, Rob, you have what to me anyway kind of seems like your baby. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but your campaign setting, the Majestic Wilderlands, as you pronounce it. A lot of people would say Wilderlands, but it is actually Wilderlands, correct?
Yes, yeah, the Majestic Wilderlands.
Wonderful. And can you explain just a little bit about where that's from and the relationship and the history there?
Yeah, sure. Well, it started back in 1980, and I got the Greyhawk Folio, and I was like, wow, look at this. You know, those huge Darlene maps, you post them up there on the wall, on your table. It's like, look at all this stuff. The problem is when you start using it, those hexes are 30 miles wide. And, you know, I was in junior high back then. So, you know, I was not as experienced. I didn't know as much as like I do now. So, you know, it's like, you go there, okay. What's in that hex? You know, you just had to keep. It was just, I call it the howling emptiness of the 30-mile hex. Then, yeah, I mean, it was a great setting, mind you, but you know, it's just trying to come up with stuff in the detail that wandering around. It was just a lot of work, and it left me frustrated, and so. I went into the store and I saw these cellophane wrap packages, Wilderlands of High Fantasy. And I opened it up and there was these maps. And I opened up the book and there's all these lists numbered by hex. And I was familiar with this because only a few months before I bought Traveler. So I knew how the Spinward Marches were set up. Great, this is for fantasy. I can use this. And so I used it and I had a campaign going on at the time and Greyhawk, and the guys were getting up into the teens, and they were wanting to make their mark, so to speak. And I decided to open up a portal and send them over to the Wilderlands of High Fantasy. And if you read the Majestic Wilderland, the Principality of Gnome was the very first thing I ever did in using the Wilderlands. And what happened was, you know, I got all the support products for it, but Judges Guild stuff, if all you had was what they put out then, there wasn't much of a world behind them. And I was a huge Tolkien fan. So I started writing up list of kings and, you know, the present date of the Wilderland was 4,433 BCC. So I went back and did 4,000 years of history. And, you know, wrote up notes, you know, not all of it went into my game. I did it much for myself as for my players. Mm-hmm. But you know, but the more I did that, even though I kind of used the base assumptions, the more it became, well, it wasn't a sword and sorcery place anymore. It was like my own world. And finally, the final nail that turned the Wilderlands of High Fantasy into the Majestic Wilderland is that, I was running the campaign with two of my old-time friends, Tim of Gothridge Manor and Dwayne of Gamer's Closet. So they decided to go from city, for some reason, they decided to go from city-state to Verdistan. And, you know, we go in NOP, I'm rolling encounter, they're having a few adventure. Then in a week went by in game and they're there. And they said, "We're there already?" And he said, "Yeah." "Man, I thought it was going to take us 3 months to get there, not a week." "Oh yeah, look here." And, you know, I like, if the players ask me, call me on a wolves question, you know, I'm perfectly fine explaining myself. So I showed them the hex and how far they moved. And wow, I thought it was bigger. So I decided from that point on the next campaign, I said, "Dude, look, guys, I'm going to make these 12.5 miles per hex." Because at that time, Harn just came out, and I was really impressed with Harn. And it had a lot of rules for encounters and movement. So I decided, hey, I can use those. I'll just make my hex the same size as theirs. And I got these new charts I can use. So I used them. And from that point on, it was the Majestic Wilderlands, not the Wilderlands of High Fantasy.
Great. Now, Rob, of course, the original Wilderlands were a Judges Guild product.
Yes.
And here you are actually releasing something related to that. How did that deal present itself? How'd that opportunity come around for you?
Well, it started with me contacting Bob Bledsoe back in 1999. And I worked with him a little bit. We were gearing up to do stuff with QuickLink Interactive, the people who make Traveler D20.
I'm familiar with Hunter.
Yeah. It didn't work out. And then they hooked up. And as you know, the guys behind Clark Peterson and, I forgot his partner's name, but those two are really big fans, and even their first dungeon, I guess, was developed into Wilderland before they, you know, released it as Necromancer Games. And so they hooked up with Bob, and they brought me on board. Bob said, "Hey, you know, I was working with these guys." So I'm one of the guys they brought on board. And that worked out really well for me. And that led on to working with Goodman Games on Madagascar, Citadel of Fire, and Dark Tower. And then recently, Bob passed away years ago, and his son is doing projects. I really can't go in detail about them. But anyway, I worked with him, with Bob Bledsoe Jr. on a couple things, and that worked out well as far as the project went. And I said, you know, I'm going to take a stab in the dark here, but I've been wanting to publish my Majestic Wilderlands. I'm working on this plan to do brand new geography, brand new, instead of city-state, it would be Eastgate. But, you know, it would save me a lot of time, and it would be more really true to my note if I could actually license the Judges Guild intellectual property. And he said yes. So I made an agreement. It's for 5 years. And so we'll... Now I have permission to publish the Majestic Wilderlands.
Oh, cool! I can only imagine from a fan standpoint how awesome that's got to be. You know, that's maybe getting a carte blanche for Greyhawk or something. You know, for me, that'd be wow. That's
yeah. Really... I do not have permission to recreate. I wouldn't say recreate, but to do what Goodman Games did and to do what Necromancer Game is: take old product, update them, and re-release them. You know, there's going to be some areas of my Majestic Wilderlands that are somewhat close that people will find very useful, particularly like the city of Burdistan, city-state itself. There are differences, but you pretty much, if you like them, you can drop them in, and it will work with either High Fantasy or Mishler's High Adventure or my Majestic Wilderlands.
Right. The works from Adventure Games Publishing, which are also very good. So, but just because this is we've talked so far about this being a setting product, but this is also very much a rule supplement, and you've said that it's compatible with the Swords and Wizardry rules, and I believe in the text, all editions based on the original 1974 role playing game, which that is. So,
I can't Dungeons and Dragons because it's a trademark. So
that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Game license.
So, what with Swords and Wizardry, was there anything that caused you to pick that as what you were using this for a rule supplement? Because I got to tell you, you know, I do have the review copy that you furnished, and there are a lot of very good options for Swords and Wizardry in this product, I felt.
Thank you.
So what caused you to pick Swords and Wizardry over, say, Labyrinth Lord, or, you know, just a more generic setting?
Well, first reason is that, believe it or not, I'm not that much of a rules guy. Okay, I'm more role-playing, plotter, managing a campaign, letting you do what you want, coming up with, if you ask questions, I'll give you the answers, and if you want to go to X instead of Y, I'm okay with that. With the rules, what happened with the rules is that I DM'd the Majestic Wilderlands in about a half a dozen role-playing games now, and I accumulated stuff that transferred to one game. And the people who know me are the old school people. So I wanted to make sure that if I presented rules, they're going to be in a system that they're going to be happy with.
Right.
So I looked at all the different retro clones, and, you know, Swords and Wizardry is pretty much the D&D. It's D&D distilled to its core. Now, White Box is, you know, replicates the very first rules of D&D. Very well, but it's not really what people play can see D&D as. The core rules are more like what people play D&D as, with the D8 for a long sword, and, you know, the full 1 through 9 levels for spells and so forth. So I decided to go with that, figuring, you know, if anybody wants to take the Majestic Wilderlands rules and use them for Osric or Labyrinth Lord, it would be a lot easier if I used Swords and Wizardry at the bay.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I tell you, the only hitch would be the saving throws, which are, you know, very different in Swords and Wizardry than most editions of D&D.
Right. Now, Rob, aside from all the regions that you detail and talking about the cultures and religions and all those things, you also have character ability, or you have individual abilities. Would you set out a system for that, basically, or an option for that, I should say?
Yes.
The races that are available as well. Some new possible characters, which I found pretty interesting as well. What would you say? I mean, this is just, to me, this felt like it really was someone's campaign that was built over time, you know, like you're kind of inviting us in to have a cup of tea, so to speak, you know, and see how you're doing.
When I clicked that submit button on Lulu, you know, I was really worried that wouldn't, I tried to write it, but, you know, I mean, even though I got a bunch of stuff published, you know, I'm still a novice at the whole writing business. And so I'm glad that came across. And you're right, it is built over time. It's built, you know, since that first day in 1980, it's been built piece by piece. And stuff that I really like, regardless when I switch from AD&D to Fantasy Hero, then on to GURPS. And then I, when D&D 3rd Edition came out, of course, I had to play that. And then I tried even a little 4E with the Majestic Wilderland. And all this stuff that you see in the book carried over. So when I chose Sword and Wizardry for the rule set, I just started out with an outline and started reading the rules and translating it over one by one.
Very cool. Now, of course, this is available on both. It's available over at lulu.com,
right,
where you've self-published as well. You also have the PDF available for $7 at RPG Now.
Yes.
And, I'm sorry, the print is $12, correct?
Yes, the printer is $12. And I have it in I don't even know how to do it. I have an original style cover that looks like a parchment. Looks like some. It could be one of the supplements for D&D. And then I have a newer style cover that I picked because I want this to appeal to both old school gamers and somebody who's playing 3E Pathfinder or any other RPG to pick up and look, oh, cool, I'll check this out.
Oh, Right. And you did name it, and you know, part of the title is Supplement 6, The Majestic Wilderlands. Now, we've already seen a Supplement 5 with the Jeffrey McKinney's Carcosa. Now, you kind of pick Supplement 6 to kind of add to that fun, I guess, would you call that more of a tribute to the original game or just your additions to the original game?
Well, actually, it was more the fact that I picked Supplement because I think the best, when I first became aware of original D&D, which was well after I started playing D&D, but I picked up the box set back in, you know, 82 or 81. And, you know, I thought Greyhawk was really cool. I thought that would be like Gary Gygax house rules. And it was obviously an expansion like any other expansion. And the same for Blackmoor. And then now comes here 30 years later, and we've seen this old school renaissance happening. And I think the best part of the old school renaissance is when somebody shares what they did, not try to fix D&D, not to try to, you know, push their version of D&D, but say, hey, look, here, this is what I did. These are the rules. These are the monsters, items. Here's a little bit about my campaign. And I think any person who does that should feel free to call themselves Supplement. Now, I pick 6 because of Gregory McKinnon's Carcosa. I know there's a little bit of controversy, but, you know, I think he showed a lot of respect for his readers by putting out the expurgated version, you know,
which I picked up as well.
In his expurgated version, I think Supplement 6 is an excellent example of the best of the old school Renaissance. It, you know, it uses D&D rules, but it's a very different kind of setting, a very different kind of feel than what you would get just playing the 3 original books.
Well, I, Rob, and, you know, I just wanted to say, I, you know, from a personal standpoint, I really enjoyed reading it. It's given me a lot of good ideas for my own campaign world and the campaign world I'm working on. So, well done. It's a great product. I'm glad we're having you on the show today. Jeff and Mark, did you have any questions?
No, actually, I just found this a very fascinating listen myself.
Yes, then again, it is the Majestic Wilderlands. And Rob, do you have anything else coming up on the plate for this, or any plans you can share with us as far as your next potential project?
My next project will be an adventure called The Beast of Kensala. It's not going to be a dungeon. It's going to be a little different than what most of the adventure has been released so far. I think people enjoyed it. It's one of the few... it's one of the it's a wilderness-based adventure, and it's one of the best standalone adventures I ever written. So I looked at all the I have about a half a dozen of these standalone adventures, and this is the best. So I hope people enjoy it.
Great. Well, again, Rob, thanks for coming on today, and you're gonna, I think, stick around for the next segment.
Sure.
For the next segment, so thank you for that.
Well, good, because we'll be more than happy to get your additional opinions on the subjects at hand. And that will actually be my subject next, which, you know, a while back I actually found this link to this site. It's called Proponomicon, and I am including it in the show notes. And it's a interesting, this guy, it's a blog, but specifically, it's very interesting, the number of what I'm going to classify as extreme props. And specifically, these are for Cthulhu, or Cthulhul, or however you want to pronounce it. Your pronunciation is about as good as anybody else's because, well, it's a made-up word, people. Mm-hmm. I only say that because I know you out there are going to tell me that I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. Well, guess what? I don't think anyone's supposed to be able to pronounce it. The whole point is that it's supposed to be a word that's incomprehensible to everybody. So there.
It would destroy your mind if you knew how to say it.
Exactly. But, you know, the effort that some of these people put into these props is just phenomenally insane. One of the ones that really comes to mind is this guy has a prop for the Arctic Expedition, which is, you know, one of the classic Cthulhu modules. And I mean, we're talking the newspaper clippings, the, you know, handwritten notes, you know, book boxes, you know, little boxes for that things were stored in. It's just like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I mean, how long did it take you to do that? You know, why, you know, to me, I've always been one that, especially in a game like that, where the props add so much to the atmosphere of the game. You know, I don't know if I would be as impressed with it in, say, a spy setting. But,
I think Cthulhu is kind of unique in the sort of props that it can inspire.
Yeah.
If you want to put it that way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was one of the more interesting ones. There was ones where, you know, the guy has, you know, photos of some of the characters that he somehow came up with. And it's just, you're just like, you're very amazed at how detailed these props are and what they use.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, I see there's like a bottled monster fetus.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. That's
things like that.
My favorite one is, I think one of them is like an alien hand, severed hand. Mm-hmm. It's just like, well, that's really cool. I mean, hand that to your player. This is what you find. I'm sure they'll automatically lose sanity in real life after seeing that.
One of the ones that impressed me the most, they have a Jade Cthulhu idol, like just a little, it looks fairly small, but it's like, wow, you know, just looking at it, it's really evocative, I guess, makes you want to jump in and start your occult investigation, you know?
Yeah. And what actually, there's not a good picture of it, but apparently, I guess back in November, one of the guys' blotter articles talked about this French LARP prop that somebody created. It was like a machine. It's called the Machine Infernal or something. And it's just like, you look at the picture and like, that took a lot of effort to create. I know it's for a LARP, and, you know, unlike most RPGs that we're playing, you know, LARPs are a little more interactive, I guess. But it's just, you look at it and you're like, I mean, the interesting thing is that when I look at these, a lot of these props are created by people who work at prop companies or production companies of some sort. I forget which article it is. I can't find it right now. But one of them, actually, the guy was selling... there were notebooks with, like, the outside of the notebook had, like, the seal of the Arty Expedition, you know. So, you know, then they had blank pages inside. So you could buy a set of these books and you could, you know, the guy that was like, yeah, these are perfect for my game notes for that campaign. I'm like, geez, that takes it to a whole new level, to say the least. Mm-hmm. You're assuming, of course, that your character survived that long to fill them. But...
This kind of brings me to mind, I had a discussion with someone the other day, and I can't remember whom, so I'm sorry, but we were discussing how, along with steampunk, Cthulhu kind of becomes almost a lifestyle for some of the gamers who enjoy that, you know. But then again, we have people who really enjoy the SCA and that sort of lifestyle for fantasy gaming.
You may not know, probably don't know about this about me, but I actually ran owned and operated a Nero Boffo LARP for 5 years, and I was involved with another one for 7 years prior to that. And when I had my second boy, I just didn't have time, and it didn't pay enough for me to continue, so I sold it off. But we're all familiar with, you know, tabletop role playing. Well, there's a whole another culture out there that involves role playing, and in they do gaming, but it's live action. And to make it even more confusing, it's not all the same. I mean, you have people doing Cthulhu, you have people doing vampire LARP, and you have people like myself who are involved in Boffer LARP, which is basically described as D&D in the woods.
Right.
And yes, they make elaborate plot props for this, and they get obsessive about it. I mean, when they get hooked on a LARP, they really get hooked.
Yeah, but the nice thing about this site, though, that I did like is that some of the articles actually link to stuff that could be useful, and even if you're not that obsessive about about it, you know, and maybe you're not using it as a LARP, maybe you want to use it as a game. One of the links actually had, like, somebody has a site where they actually have, you know, paint, you know, like if you do stuff in GIMP or Photoshop, they actually have brushes shape various things. Like this one that I see right here is postal seals, you know, from various locations. So you could, you know, use it to create, you know, your postal envelopes or whatever props that you wanted to use. So yeah, that's kind of cool because, you know, I don't have all the time and effort to create those things, you know, and obviously they do point out that, you know, some of these things are technically trademarked. So it's not like you can use them and publish them and sell them, you know. Believe it or not, yes, the little postal seal that you have on your envelope, that's trademarked by the U.S. Postal Service.
There's something about Colors of Cthulhu that lends itself. Back in, you know, 83 when I was in high school, every Colors of Cthulhu game, the handful of Colors of Cthulhu game I was involved, every, I guess I call them keepers, not Dungeon Masters, but every keeper of the who ran these games, they make props for it, and they enjoy just handing them out.
Well, you know what
it
is that a lot of the original modules had quite a few props of their own already in the production of these things, you know, be it the notes or the other things. And I think it's the setting too. You know, most of them are set, you know, in the 20s and in the 30s. And it's, you know, as a mindset, we tend to, it's kind of, it puts you in a more proper mindset, you know, to actually be there, you know, feel that you're there. I mean, I forget which one it is that involves the Orient Express. Is it I forget which module it is, but they literally have, you know, large map sections of the train. So you can actually interact on the train. It's quite impressive the amount of effort that they originally, when some of these modules were produced, how much effort they put into them.
The way I see it, the reason why you would use props, especially for Call of Cthulhu, is that it adds, even though everybody knows it's a fake prop, it does add a little bit more realism to it, because it's difficult to be scared about something in a horror game, because, you know, it's just a game, and I think that adding in props adds a little bit more evocative, you know, it's more evocative, and if, you know, you're handed over a 1920s library card for your character to Miskatonic University, you know, it feels a lot more real, and you begin to sort of go into that mindset.
I think it also helps with game ownership and immersion, you know, just the effort going into it helps you.
I know the effect on our game was that we ran D&D, didn't have a whole lot of props. You know, the DM would describe something like a book or something, and we play essentially 20 questions. But with all this Cthulhu game, what happened is we find something, the DM hands us this folder. Like, ooh, and what immediately happens is it's a little bit of live action role playing there. We all huddle around the table, we open up that folder, and we sort it out. Joe would take one sheet, Dwayne would take another, and Tim and we'd start arguing over it. So yeah, they really add a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, especially also, you know, I think also part of it too is that Call of Cthulhu, they don't call them investigators for nothing. So I think especially in any type, and I think this is true if you were playing like a murder mystery type game, it's the props, because you need, you know, the evidence as props helps, you know, it's very hard. I think that's one of the reasons that I've never really seen a good, what I'm going to call, fantasy mystery. I've thought about it many times, you know, because I'm a firm believer that fantasy, you know, you can do so many other sub things in fantasy besides the save the princess routine, you know, and I've always thought that, you know, I'm almost like a murder mystery would be very interesting. Hard problem is, of course, is that it's very hard to invoke the mystery of, you know, hey, we got this evidence, we have these clues, or, you know, you're expected to do that more in Call of Cthulhu. So I think props help you invoke this is a piece of evidence. I don't know exactly what I'm looking at, but I'm looking at a piece of evidence. And the players get to, you know, do what most people love to do. You know, that's the great thing about, like, watching, you know, or reading Sherlock Holmes is, you know, you try to find the evidence. You know, he points out the evidence to you, but you're still trying to put it together yourself, you know? And I think that's what really happens with the props.
when we were playing a game, it wasn't Call of Cthulhu, but a game of 4th edition D&D, I had my players find a piece of paper that I actually made a piece of paper for, and it was written in Draconic, and so I used from the Draconomicon all the Draconic letters and stuff, and actually used their little dictionary of Draconic words, so the thing was entirely in Draconic, and I wrinkled it up, and I made it all blood-soaked and everything. And they actually had to sit down, and they all huddled around the table trying to translate what this document was.
Mm-hmm. Well, so
I think you can add a lot of that.
That's something like that came up in our last game. We had one guy who had a translation spell he could use. So everyone else, I made one scroll that was absolute gibberish, and one scroll that he basically, when he looked at it, that's what he got to read. So that was kind of neat. Scrolls and paper has always been a little bit easier for me. I fail at some other props, but I'm okay
I think go ahead, Rob.
Okay. It wasn't for tabletop, but the single best prop I felt I ever did was for a live action game. And what I did, I went to a garden store, and you know how you have those ceramic pots with bottoms, they're like little dishes.
Right.
So I bought 8 of them. I went home and I took some paint and I painted these absolutely crude pictograph, but they told a story. And then I took them to the event, and then I smashed them and I scattered the pieces around the site. And much of the plot of the weekend was the player going around the site, finding these pieces, put together what led them to clues to the various modules, which they resolved the mystery of the event.
Very cool.
Wow, that sounds like an archaeological dig.
Hey, there was some guy, there was like a group of 3 guys out at 6 o'clock in the morning trying to hunt down these part shards. I guess I interpreted, but they got pretty ups, and they went around and traded for the other player's part shard because they wanted to complete, they got to collect them all, you know, just like Pokemon or something. I was like, what are you doing up this early? Oh, we got to get those pop charts. Can you tell us where you put them, Rob? No, I'm not going to tell you. Go find them.
You know you're doing something very, very right if your players are up at 6 a.m. in the morning for that. That's wow.
That's actually kind of cool. So
that's pretty awesome.
Go ahead.
There was one more site that I had found, CthulhuLives.org, that's the Cthulhu Historical Society. They have some pretty amazing props on there that are all in PDF form that you can print out.
Oh, that's cool.
They're all 1920s era stuff, so if you're playing 1920s era Cthulhu, you can use that.
Which is fairly common.
They have library cards. They have coroner's toe tags. So if you get sent into the coroner to look over a body, you can hand over the toe tag. Auto registration, driver's licenses. They have a library book conversion kit, which allows you to actually print out and make those sort of pockets that are always in the front of the older library books where you put in the who borrowed the book and when they checked it out and things like that.
Right.
And you can actually assemble that whole thing, and it's all for Miskatonic University's library. They have certificates of insanity. Ingredients for 1920s newspaper, so different fonts and things like that that you can assemble. Death certificates. They've got just a ton of stuff on there, and it's all very, very evocative.
Well, that's very cool. We'll include that in the show notes, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
all right, well, I think we're going to close off this section, but before I do, everyone out there, I want you to go ahead and, if you have a great prop that you've used in the game, please let us know in an audio comment later on, or just shoot us an email, or obviously in the comments on the post for this podcast. So, because props have always fascinated me. It's one of the most underutilized things that I do. I don't use a lot of props, and I've always hated myself for it. So I'm always fascinated with them.
Yeah.
So.
We need like a great prop cookbook, you know, just a bunch of, you know, like the gaming community all put together like a big guide for
how to make props.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. I have one last prop thing that's good. That would be great for tabletop. And it was developed by my friend Tim at Gothridge Manor. What you do is you make a bulletin board, and when a players go into a city, you before the game you write up, notices, notes, requests, lists, anything that you want to have for a lead for an adventure. Mm-hmm. You tack it all up, you set it on your table, and when your players enter the city, you reveal it. Says, "Do you see this over next to the gate?" And the players go over and look at it. And it's a lot of fun watching them go over the board and picking and choosing.
Oh, that would be fun.
That's awesome.
All the red herrings and all that. Yeah,
I would totally do that.
Totally.
Yeah, that sounds like a winner. So there you go, folks. Your suggestion for the day for your campaign are your adventures. Mm-hmm. So lastly, we're gonna shift over to Mark, and you're gonna talk to us about RPGs that are not exactly RPGs.
Yeah. What I'm talking about here is board games and card games that aren't technically RPGs, but they really are RPGs. The one that probably would stand out to most people would be Descent: Journeys in the Dark. Have any of you guys seen that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's a fantasy flight game, and it's DM versus players, but it's a board game in that the DM's whole job is to kill the players. So it is competitive in that way, like a board game. But the reason why you'd want to even look at a game like this is that a lot of times you won't have all your players show up for a game. And so you can have the like maybe two people who are there sit down and they can play games like this. But Descent is really great. And I believe on their website, they actually have rules for making your own characters in Descent. So you could actually take your character that you've currently got in your current D&D game, and then when not everybody's able to show up, you can still have your character go dungeon delving with a DM.
Mm-hmm.
Have any of you guys seen Betrayal at House on the Hill?
Betrayal on House on the Hill.
It's a horror board game by Avalon Hill.
That Avalon Hill, and that's the one. Is that the one with the deck of like floor cards?
Yeah, and okay. You can move between floors and everything.
I've played that one several times. That's the one that it's sort of an interesting. It's like every time you play, it's kind of a different game.
Yeah,
right.
And one person is the traitor, and so everybody's sort of exploring around the house. And at some point, the traitor will be revealed, and everybody's basically got to get out of the house while the traitor's trying to kill them all.
Right, but no one knows who the traitor is, and even the traitor himself when you start. So
exactly, yeah. But that can add. You can actually do a lot of role playing with that game too. When Darkness Comes, I had this game for a while, and I'm actually not sure what happened. I think it disappeared in one of my moves. But it's a horror based board game that each person plays like a specific character, and basically this vast evil is coming and taking over this town. I can't really give you any details beyond that, but that was just one of the ones that I remember from having it back in the day. Arkham Horror also.
Yeah, I've played that too.
Played that? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that one, I ended up playing one game where I think the game probably lasted about 2 hours longer than it needed to, because we were actually getting into the characters and pretending to be the characters as we were moving around the town.
Well, it's kind of, especially in that one, it's kind of hard because you start looking at some of the characters and you're like, yeah, I can relate to this guy, or you know, you're playing some tough guy or somebody else, or it's very interesting because you start looking like, well, who do I want to play? I'll take this one. This one looks interesting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, especially since there are player cards, so there's different and they have different abilities. You kind of, it's not like everyone is following the same rules in a way.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's specifically what in many of these cases, that's what these games have in common, is that at some level they have a character card where that character card is different from the other character cards. Because I know in Betrayal on Haunted Hill, you don't really have character cards per se. You have that weird, funky little hexagonal.
Yeah.
You know,
little Tracker.
Yeah, tracker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they have, you know, depending on which character you are, you know, the tracker has different values. And so, yeah, there's it. You do effectively, that is your character sheet. And I mean, I guess it says also a lot about these type of games and their influence, especially with the fact that, you know, the latest version of Warhammer is almost a rapid extension of this to a little bit more of an extreme, I think.
Yeah. And if you look at pretty much anything made by Fantasy Flight, a lot of their board games really are pretty much role-playing games. You look at, like, Android, which is a sci-fi setting where you're investigating murders, and of course they did the new Warhammer role-playing game, and they also made Descent. So yeah, I think those are all really good places to look. Do you guys know of any other?
Well, I was actually going to say Warhammer, which is kind of a hybrid with its specialty parts and the way it's presented. But I mean, that I think part of that is because of what Fantasy Flight's known for. They were kind of sticking with their strengths. Also, you can't really pirate a board game, which, you know, you can pirate the bejesus out of a, you know, just a standard RPG rule book. And I kind of wonder in the back of my head in a couple years when we see D&D 5th edition, if it will be not only with an online subscription model, but more skewed towards something where you have the specialty cards and the specialty dice for tracking to actually cut down on piracy and to make sure, you know, to encourage that style of play.
Oh, yeah, I could definitely see that.
Yeah, I think it might happen, but we'll see, I guess.
You know, I hope not. But, you know, I think it just might be another fork in the road, so to speak. Other games that are kind of like that for me that I've played has to be a few of the old, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of cheap-ass games.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Lucky.
Mm-hmm. Kill Dr. Lucky is one. You know, that eventually got sold to somebody else, and somebody else produced a version of that. And then my personal favorite is Ben-Hurt.
I have not seen that one.
Yeah, it's not in print anymore, which is a shame because I really wanted to pick up a copy. I only get to play with it with my buddy because he has a copy of it. It's Roman Chariot Racing.
And it's called Ben-Hurt instead of Ben-Hurt.
Nice.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
You know, and it's great because, you know, you don't get to, you know, you have your, you know, you move your chariots around the thing, and basically you're playing effectively the guy who owns, you know, the race teams, if you will. But still, even in that, you kind of get that thing because, you know, you have all the whole, you know, you buy equipment and you buy drivers and stuff. And, you know, you kind of get into that role-playing model where you feel you are the Roman guy, you know, throwing these things out there. Plus just the ridiculous stuff that happens in the game. Like one of the tools that, one, you know, because you have all this bidding that goes on for these specialty cards that you can get. And some of the specialty cards are ridiculous, like the cat, where you get to throw the cat at the opposing player. And that, like, slows him down or something. But now he has the cat. Or, you know, you get extra movement because your chariot has big wheels or something stupid like that. Stuff that doesn't really apply in physics, but just is fun to... Honestly, if you guys can ever find a copy of it anywhere, I'd suggest picking it up because it's a fun little game.
That's an awesome title. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's two other cheap-ass ones. Captain Park's Imaginary Polar Expedition.
That's right.
Basically, yeah, you're wandering around London trying to find artifacts that you can bring back to your local gentleman's club to show them how you went on these amazing expeditions.
But didn't really.
But actually, you spent the entire time hanging out in London.
That sounds fantastic.
And the enemy chocolatier, which is very similar. It's, you're basically all the enemies of Willy Wonka.
You know, I swear that's there were a lot of cheap ass games that had some really interesting titles.
Sure did.
You know, I mean, so.
Jeff, were you with me when I saw Yetisburg at Paizo at Gen Con?
Yes, I believe so.
It was actually North versus South, 1863. Except you have a Yeti in your army. And I kept looking at that game because I thought Yetisburg was like one of the funniest game titles I ever heard. But I digress.
As we often do here.
Yeah, it's nothing new. I do. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
Okay. The first time, I'm going to probably sound totally retro for saying this, but the first game I ever encountered, a board game that had like a strong role-playing component, was BattleTech. I know back when it was all, the first rage for BattleTech was in about around 86. And it was the bread and butter for my college gaming club's fundraising, because we could hold a BattleTech tournament and everybody was willing to pay a $5 fee to enter it, and we'll raise a couple hundred bucks. And, you know, they got really personal about their mechs and, you know, the pilots that.
I think you're right. I think that's why the whole Mech Warrior thing got spawned off, which was, you know, the eventual RPG for BattleTech.
Mm-hmm. And I know the guys over at Fear the Boot.
Have you read the first version of Mech Warrior?
What was that?
Yeah.
Have you read the first version of Mech Warrior?
No.
It was they may have called it a role-playing game, but it was really a war game on an individual level. I mean, it was anything outside of fighting or piloting a mech, there was very little.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. You know, I actually saw and read for some brief period of time the first edition of BattleTech, which was called Battle Droids. And that was actually very interesting, because the basic game didn't actually play like the advanced game. The advanced game played like the games that we played, you know, what BattleTech eventually was. But like the initial rules were kind of like super simplified, to the point that it really was a completely different game. So but it was very interesting. And of course they changed the name, of course, because, well, George Lucas sued them.
Well, I'm also thinking, I'm sorry. Go ahead, man.
Oh, I know that over at Fear the Boot, the guys, they're constantly talking about the BattleTech role-playing game. And everybody asked him, what are you guys talking about? There's a MechWarrior role-playing game. It turns out that basically they've always integrated the BattleTech board game with the MechWarrior role-playing game, like completely integrated them together. And that's how they always played their campaign.
Yeah,
so
they're not the only ones. Yeah, I've heard of other people doing that as well.
Yeah, I think that was a fairly popular option.
I did too. But I think also, you know, when we're thinking about board games that can be played as role-playing games, you have to think back to the origins of the hobby, you know, and war games being played as role-playing games, you know, with Major Wesley's Bronstein. You know, here we've got these figures arrayed on the board and everything. What's your Prussian infantry going to do? And then, you know, oh, wait, now you play this spy, you play this student, you play this captain. So I think there's definitely that link there, especially you think when you were a kid and you played Risk or Monopoly or, you know, whatever you became for a little while. It was pretty common, I think, to become the Red Army's commander for a while, you know, and kind of speak in imperious tones when you're invading Kamchatka or wherever, or, you know, in Monopoly, become the banker and, you know, really become an absolute miser.
The first game I ever had that happen to me was Starfleet Battles.
Yeah, oh, really? Yeah.
There
sure.
You go. Now there's a game, yeah, that probably involved a lot of that.
Good example.
Well, actually, it didn't so much. You know, BattleTech is really one that brought it together. Starfleet Battles definitely had the prototypes of that kind of rule. You could even make up characters. You had your legendary captain, legendary science officer, and the whole thing. In fact, I still remember the legendary captain rule. If you roll three sixes, like three sixes in a row, he'll somehow manage to wind up on the enemy's ship and take it over. That's one of his abilities. Wow. Yeah, ship blows up, roll three sixes in a row, and the player gets to pick one of your ships, and his captain takes it over.
That sounds like a Kirkism if I ever hear. No, all right. Well, I think that about wraps up that segment. We are actually, you know, towards the end of our show here. Unfortunately, this to go around, we didn't have any audio comments, but that's okay. I mean, we've been out for a while, and this is the first episode in about a month. So I'm very happy with that. However, if any of you out there do have an audio comment you'd like to give us, you can do it one of three ways. You can obviously record it and email it to us at info@rpgcircus.com, or leave us a voicemail message. And there's two ways to do that. First one is to call our toll-free number. That is 1-888-643-6322. Again, that's 1-888-643-6322. Or you can call us on Skype at RPG Circus and leave a voicemail message there. Or, of course, you know, you can always just email us at info@rpgcircus, and we'll be more than happy to read your written comments and reply to them when we have a chance. And with that, I think that pretty much closes up this episode. Does anyone have any closing comments?
Please leave us some audio comments. We always love hearing them.
All right. I think that pretty much does it for us this time. Podcast is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution US license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.